I'd been thinking about this section of scripture in 1 and 2 Samuel for a few days, and I thought perhaps in light as well of current circumstances in Westminster, it might be good to remind ourselves of a throne that has been set in heaven. And despite all of the uncertainty of political goings-on in this country, God has established his man upon a throne. I have another reason for wanting to interest you in these two books, and perhaps a slightly academic reason, but I trust it might be of interest. And that is just to think for a little bit about how we're to study and read and to understand some of these historical books from the Old Testament. Perhaps about 7 or 8 years ago or so, when I was out in Perth in Australia, we studied 1 and 2 Samuel in Bible class over a good number of months. And I must say, it's probably the first time I'd ever studied these books in a consecutive manner. And as I did, I came to realize that I had very little understanding about the purpose of the books. Now, I was familiar with the events, the historical events, but I knew about them in an isolated way, perhaps from my Sunday school days. You know, the story of David and Goliath and the story of David and Bathsheba and various stories, the killing of Jonathan and Saul and so on. And I came to think that actually my understanding of historical narrative in the Old Testament was almost limited to thinking of it like a scrapbook, almost like little individual stories that we pick up from time to time if we want to tell a Sunday school story, or we perhaps want to try to apply a little message from somewhere, and we just pluck out half a dozen verses from the life of David and apply it. Or perhaps from time to time, people want to try to use certain events to be a type of the Lord, and again, they somewhat pluck it out of context and apply it. Now, I came to think that we wouldn't do that with a New Testament book. You wouldn't do that even with a historical New Testament book like the Gospels. You wouldn't do that with John's Gospel, would you? You wouldn't think that John just had a number of individual isolated stories that he wanted to record, like history, and he just plucked a bit of this and this and the woman at the well story and then somebody at the temple and Nicodemus and so on, just so that we had a little stories that we could sermonize. We know better than that when we come to John. In fact, John tells us there was a reason why he wrote. He wrote these things that we might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. So he carefully selected his material, historical though it was, and he put it together, not like a scrapbook, not just individual stories trying to make a case, but clearly he carefully collected his stories by the inspiration of God and put it in a structured, logical way to try to make a case, that case being in particular that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. And he ordered it in such a way that we could follow it, actually. You find that John's Gospel, for example, is very straightforward in its ordering. There were four specific trips that the Lord Jesus made to Jerusalem. And his material is centered around those four visits that he makes to Jerusalem, the last one, of course, being when he was crucified. And so there's a flow, there's a thought pattern that runs through it, there's a particular gathering of material, each one of them trying to make the case, the ultimate case that John's trying to prove. Well, if you come to 1 and 2 Samuel, if I ask you the question, if we take these two books together for a moment, why were they written? What was the case that was trying to be made? And how does the writer go about trying to make that case? If we think that other books in the new, even of a historical genre, are put together in that way to make us think that way, to think that there's a case and to prove it, how would we go about doing the same with 1 and 2 Samuel, if you like, want to take two books as one? So it got me thinking along these kinds of lines, and we did some study in that. And I want to suggest to you, therefore, that when you come to these books as perhaps at three levels that are worth trying to understand historical, Old Testament historical narrative at this level. The first is just to understand what happened. and what events were recorded, not just as individual isolated events, but what events are happening and what case is the historian, if I could put it in that sense. God obviously lying behind that as the divine inspirer of the scripture. But what case at the level that it was written at? Why did the historian record these events? What was the case he was trying to make? And I suggest he was trying to make a case. I know sometimes historians just try to fill in a blank bit that we don't know about in history. Sometimes historians do that. I'm looking at an expert historian, of course, in the back here. But I would find that that's a little bit of a waste of time, if you ask me. Well, not necessarily a waste of time, but I think generally historians have more about them than that. That they're actually often trying to prove a point about what that history meant. And sometimes they're trying to uphold a truth or set aside falsehoods. And they've gone and investigated what happened, and they make a case for something. Often, sometimes it's about a person. You think of biographies and so on that have been written about people in the past, and it's often to try to paint a true portrait of that person. So I suggest what might lie behind 1 and 2 Samuel then is a very simple purpose, and that is to uphold David's right to be king. Now let me prove that to you, if I could, by turning to 2 Samuel chapter 16 to get a flavor of some of the inaccuracies and falsehood that might have been circulating in Israel about David's right to be king. You see, we have been used to just accepting it, that David was the rightful king. But stop for a minute and think about how this might have looked to people who were ill-informed in Israel's history. Suppose that the historian had not recorded this for us, and all you heard were rumors about David. You might have heard some rumors like this. Well, David went into the palace and he raised a conspiracy against Saul, and he got people on his side and tried to make a division and got Jonathan and Michael and some of Saul's servants and got the high priest and all of these on his side to try to make a conspiracy against Saul and managed to, you know, make a division. It might have raised another innuendo about David, and so there was a period in David's life when he was over with the Philistines, and there was the battle went on when Jonathan and Saul were killed and David was with them. What right does he have to be king? Mind you, it's a very good point, isn't it? What right would he have to be king if he was part of the battle when Saul and Jonathan were killed? Might also raise some questions about where he got his wife from and how he got Michael, and various other moral questions that would be raised about David. So you could see, actually, if there was no history of this, then there might be a question mark over David's right to be king. Not only that, but just stop to think about what actually happened. God transferred the kingship from one tribe to another tribe, from the tribe of Benjamin, Saul's tribe, to the tribe of Judah, to David. Now that never happened with the priesthood, did it? You never heard of God saying to the tribe of Levi, I'm sorry, I'm removing the priesthood from your tribe and I'm moving it to another tribe. So let's think, this is an immense historical event in Israel's history. God is about to take the kingship from a tribe of Benjamin and transfer it to another tribe of David, of Judah, under David. You say, does it matter historically? Would it matter whether that was upheld as actually what happened? Think of the significance to the New Testament. What if there was any question about David's right to be king and whether he got to the throne by legitimate means or not? What question mark would that put over the Lord's right to be king? So now you can see that there is a very good role here for historians in this world, believe it or not. It's a very noble task that the historian has carried out here, to uphold David's right to be king, because it would eventually be the basis on which we have confidence that the Lord is the rightful king. Now, we don't have time too much to have a look at this, but 2 Samuel chapter 16, you might remember David is being hunted out of Jerusalem by Absalom. And as he crosses the brook Kedron with his men fleeing from Absalom and in distress, there's a man here by the name of Shimei. In verse 5 of chapter 16 of 2 Samuel, it says this, "And when King David came to Behurim, behold, thence came out a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. He came forth and cursed still as he came, and he cast stones at David and at all the servants of King David, and all the people and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. And thus said Shimei when he cursed, 'Come out, thou bloody man, and thou man of Belial. The Lord hath returned upon thee all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose stead thou hast reigned. And the Lord hath delivered the kingdom into the hand of Absalom thy son. And behold, thou art taken in thy mischief, because thou art a bloody man.'" Now, let's take this accusation that comes from Shimei, a man who came from the tribe of Benjamin, from the very place, of course, where Saul had come from. Now, let's suppose even that this sense of injustice might have only been in the tribe of Benjamin, but at least that's one out of 12 tribes. And here's a man who's saying this: you got to the throne by foul means, and now that you're being rejected, God is judging you and repaying to you what you deserve, because this is effectively what you did to Saul, who came from the tribe of Benjamin. You were responsible for ultimately for the death of Saul and Jonathan. Blood is on your hands, David. Now, I suggest that might have been a relatively widespread view. So you can see now that even at this point in time, there was a question mark in the minds of some in Israel as to precisely how David got to the throne and whether it was by foul means or whether it was God who brought him to the throne. So I take it then, at a historical level, that is the primary function of these two books, to uphold David's right to be king. Now, there's another level that we could look at it. It's the moral level, if you like. So not just what happened historically and what particular case the historian was trying to make, but whether within that history God was trying to teach them lessons. Like, why did he do that? Why did he set Saul aside? Why did he take up David? Did God just act in an arbitrary way, or were there moral reasons for it? In other words, upholding now God's actions. Why did God do it? And a lot of the Old Testament is for that reason. You take books like Jeremiah and Ezekiel and so on, Isaiah. Very long, lengthy books, often with very long appeals, if you like, from God about why he's going to have to judge the nation and put them into the hands of the Babylonians. Why all those lengthy, long books? I would suggest to you because there would have been some doubt in the minds of the nation of Israel, perhaps generations later. What kind of a God allowed his own people for this to happen to them? But before it happened, God showed that he was pleading with the nation. He was upholding his moral justice as to why he was doing it. So some of these books in the Old Testament, it was almost God putting on record why he would do such and such a thing. Not that God acted arbitrarily, but showed his moral character, his moral judgment. And so we're going to see in Saul's life, for instance, why did God set Saul aside? Was it just an arbitrary change that he decided he didn't want now somebody from the tribe of Benjamin, but he wanted somebody from the tribe of Judah? Or were there moral reasons for it? Of course, you know that he's going to speak about David as a man after his own heart. There will be a moral reason why God will set aside the first man, Saul, and take up the second man, David. But at a third level then, so having established in your mind the historical narrative and why what happened and why it was recorded and what particular case was being made, and thinking perhaps behind that about why God did what he did and why God would have it recorded for us, then there is perhaps a third level that you would almost flows on naturally from that is this. If we've learned already what happened, and we've been told why it happened, why God did what he did, it might raise in our minds another question, which is this. Was God intending us to understand how he did it? Or did it matter how he brought David to the throne? What I mean by that is this. Why didn't God just get rid of Saul as soon as Saul failed? God anointed David, didn't he, when he was a lad, 16 or so. Why did he not just bring him in and put him on a throne then? Why did he allow Saul and David to carry on in parallel for quite a number of years before he eventually would bring David to the throne? What was God's strategy about how he did it? And if we were to understand that, we might ask ourselves, therefore, a question. If God went about this in a particular way, and he had a particular strategy in mind, did he have this in his mind to be a precept or a precedence or a prototype, if you like, of a greater strategy that he might have in mind for David's greatest son when he would bring him into the world and when he would eventually bring him on a throne? We might begin to wonder, the way that God brought David to the throne wasn't haphazard, wasn't arbitrary, but was meant to put in our minds a picture of precisely what he would do in a future day when he would bring his son ultimately to the throne. So three levels in. Now, I'm going to skate over the first two fairly quickly and try to avoid delving into the third until the end, although I might go from level one to level three from time to time, but you'll excuse that. It's not quite like the first heaven, second heaven, third heaven, but nevertheless, we'll start off at the basic historical level. And I want to do that just to try to get you to see that there is structure and that there are ways in which the writer is gathering events to make a case, a historical case. Let's think about that first accusation that I raised about, was it a conspiracy that David was trying to plot in the palace? And in fact, if you want to take David's life at a basic level, it's split in two. First of all, you've got really his time up to the throne that we read about in chapters 5, 6, and 7. And then you're going to get his reign from chapter 8, or the end of chapter 8, on to the end of 2 Samuel. Now, within the first section of how God brings him to the throne, we might divide that in three. The first is this, his time in Israel, primarily in the palace, but then also when he's being chased by Saul. Then there'll be a period at the end of 1 Samuel when he's in Philistine, in the land of the Philistines. And then there's going to be a period in the first 5 or 6 chapters of 2 Samuel from the time that Saul and Jonathan are killed till eventually he's brought to the throne. And let's just think of these three sections from a historical point of view and see that the stories go together to make a case. So the first suggestion I'm going to make to you is that in that time in his time in Israel, that the great question mark is this a conspiracy? Is he trying to undermine Saul's leadership by means of a conspiracy? Now, we've got great examples at the moment in our country of precisely what that looks like. People that plot and scheme to get to the throne. And of course, what actually happens is that very often they are caught by their own mischief and they reap what they sow. I think we've seen a little bit of that in our own day. What about David? How did he get to the throne? Was it by means of a conspiracy? Now, interestingly, with the writer here, when you go through these chapters 17, 18, 19, 20, probably through to the end of 26, you're going to be looking at now David's relationship with Saul in particular. Was it a conspiracy? Was he plotting to overthrow Saul? So you begin by asking yourself the question, well, how did he manage to get in with all of these people in the palace? How did he get in with Michael? How did he get in with Jonathan? How did he manage to get in with Saul's servants? How did he get in with the high priest and so on? Where did he manage to get all these relationships from? You might think it was, if you were looking at it from a fleshly point of view, you would say he's a master tactician, just trying to win political allegiance over to his side. But the writer makes it very careful to tell us precisely why people pledged allegiance to David. In chapter 18, there are four references to the word love. It says, first of all, Jonathan loved him. And it says that Michael loved him. And it says that all Israel loved him. And then it says that Saul's servants loved him. And basically what the writer is plotting, is showing us is this. How David won the allegiance of people within the palace. There was no conspiracy. And you remember that Saul actually uses this word conspire a number of times. And deceiving. He says to Michael, remember when she made a straw man to get David out of the room? And so Saul says, you've deceived me. You've plotted against me. And then he raises that accusation against Jonathan. Jonathan, you've deceived me to go over to this man, the son of Jesse's side. Then he goes down. You remember he calls the high priest up and the priests and so on that had helped David when he'd gone out. And the whole accusation was, you've conspired against me. Now you can see now the historian is setting the matter straight about this. There was no conspiracy on David's part. The allegiance that he won from people was an allegiance that was won by love. They had seen what David did to Goliath. They had seen what David had done to the Philistines, and they loved him of their own volition. Now, I say this just as a slight aside, if you like. Sometimes I hear sermons, and I would hate to cut across other people's sermons on some of these things. But I sometimes hear people say, you know, when David went down to the priest's house and so on, that they would liken that. Here's an example of what happens when you lie. And all the mischief that's caused about lying. And I would just ask a very simple question. Was that the purpose of why this was written? Well, not if you think about the main point. The main point was to uphold David's right to be king. To show that there was no conspiracy. He wasn't conspiring against Saul at all. In fact, his motive for going down there was because he was trying to avoid conflict with Saul. Not to conspire against him. So what I just add that as a word of warning. Be very careful on applications of individual stories out of context, because the context will show us why they were written. And there's a whole lot of stories in those chapters that are all building the same case. There was no conspiracy. Now to prove that, he's going to go on and answer another question. But what about David's army? Did he not have an army? I suppose if word got out that Tom Black here, if he had got himself an army from Bicester and went down to Westminster, I suppose it might cause a little kerfuffle at the moment down there. They might think the Northern Irish were taking over or something like that, and that they were going to usurp the Prime Minister. It was a reasonable thing, wasn't it? What was David doing with an army? I mean, if that was just the headline of the newspaper that you read in Israel, David has an army. Well, you suppose I know precisely what he's going to do with that army. But again, the writer tells us from chapter 22, 23, 24, a few of these chapters, what does David do with his army? And the obvious thing is this, he does not fight against Saul and Saul's men with that army. In fact, that army came when he was in the cave of Adullam. He didn't go out looking for a bunch of mercenaries. These were men that just went out on their own volition to pledge allegiance to David. And he uses that army at times to fight the enemy, not to fight Saul. In fact, then the writer shows us on two occasions, you remember chapter 24 and 26, when David had a chance to kill Saul. And what does he do now with his own hand? That's the question. Not just what does he do with his army, but what will he do with his own hand? Will he lift up his own hand against Saul? The answer to that is no. Just to prove to you that these chapters are not randomly placed together, those two stories look very similar, don't they? 24 and 26. Two times when he could have lifted up a sword and slain Saul with his own hand. And those words are mentioned, my own hand. I would not lift up my own hand against the Lord's anointed. Chapter 25 is a very strange story about Nabal and Abigail. What happens in that story? What's the point? Is this just a random, you know, like sometimes you end up with holiday snaps and there's a picture taken and it's in the middle of the holiday book later off and you think, I have no idea how that got there. I'm not even sure if that was on the same holiday, but nevertheless, it's a lovely picture of so-and-so at the airport. It's got no relevance to the rest of the pictures. You read through chapter 25, you know what that story tells us? You remember there was Nabal, he's going to do a bit of disservice to David and so on. And David wakes up one morning after that, says to his men, right, let's go down and sort Nabal out. And he's on his way down. And Abigail meets him and convinces him not to go down. Do you know what she says to him? Look, he's a hopeless fellow. And more to the point, what she says to him to convince him is this. When you get to the throne, David, what will people say if you've just lifted up your own hand against a fellow like Nabal? What will people think of you? What will that do to your reputation if people find out that's just with what you do with people like Nabal? Do you know what David says? He says to her, thank you very much for preventing me from shedding blood with my own hand. Now you can see now that that story fits in perfectly with chapter 24 and 26 because it's showing us that David is not the kind of man that will lift up his own hand to get his own way to reach the throne. Now that brings us to the end of that first section. I've got 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes left. The next section, David with the Philistines. Now there's another one. David gets a right going over for this. By the way, I think there is a clear distinction actually between the first half of David's life when he gets to the throne and then from chapter 8 of 2 Samuel onwards to the end. And it's this. When the writer wants to show us that David sinned, he makes it clear. He says the thing that David did displeased the Lord. With the sin of Bathsheba, with the numbering of the people at the end of 2 Samuel, they both fall after David has come to the throne. Now, I'm not suggesting that David is sinless or anything like that, but what I'm suggesting to you is that in this first part of how God gets David to the throne, the intention of the writer is not for us to critique David's motives for doing things. I could prove that to you, I think, even when he goes out to the Philistines, because that's one where people say, can you imagine? Here's David. He doesn't just go to the Philistines. You remember where he goes to, don't you? Gath. Gath. I remember somebody from Gath once. I think his name was Goliath. Fancy David doing that. And the preachers give him a right, you know, going out to the Gentiles and doing all of this and that and so on. Listen to what the writer says that David said. In chapter 26, when Saul is sort of saying to David, look, I'm sorry, I've been chasing you and so on. David says this. He says, at the second half of it, he says, they have driven me out this day from abiding in the inheritance of the Lord. Verse 19, saying, go serve other gods. They have driven me out of the inheritance. Chapter 27 begins and David goes over to the Philistines. Now let's think back to this historical question. Was David a turncoat? Did he turn against his own people? Was he going to turn against Saul and Jonathan? Is this how he's going to get to the throne? Why was he over with the Philistines in the first place? Think of the historical significance of this. It raises a big question mark, doesn't it, against him? But what's David's answer for it? You've driven me out from the land of my inheritance. Yeah, there's a very big question mark, wasn't there, when the gospel went out to the Gentiles? It went first to the Jews, and then it went to... What was the answer? Well, I could use the words of David, you've driven me out. The nation of Israel rejected the Messiah. They put him on a cross. They rejected the gospel that was preached to them. It went out to the Gentiles. It was a strange tactic, wasn't it, to go out to the Gentiles? Mind you, it was a strange tactic, a strange thing that David did. I would grant you that. There's an interesting thing that the king of Gath says. He says this when they're about to go out to the battle, and the kings, the Philistine kings are having a discussion whether they should take David. And I can't understand everything about that or why David was going to go and so on. You know what the king of Gath says? He says, one thing is this. I've considered this fellow, and all the time he's been with me, I find no fault in him. Amazing testimony, wasn't it? Mind you, there was a day, of course, when another Gentile leader said the same thing about the rightful king of Israel. I find no fault in this man. Whatever you take of why David was there, and whatever he thought he was going to do going with those kings off to the battle, the historian records for us in extreme careful detail where David was when the battle took place, when Saul and Jonathan were killed. And you know what? God turned David around and he ended up going in the complete opposite direction from where that battle took place. And there's very careful historical detail to show us that David was nowhere near the battle that was ultimately to bring down Saul and Jonathan, to uphold David's right to be king. Then the next section in the first five or six chapters of 2 Samuel. Again, this would almost read like what happens in Westminster. There's a whole lot of people now that see an opportunity to try to make David king. You remember there's an Amalekite young man and he comes with a crown, with Saul's crown, bracelets and so on. And he says, you can almost imagine him, David, here, I'll make you king, and maybe you could give me some position then in your kingdom, and I'll get some influence, and I might even be the counselor of the exchequer or whatever. Get some position in parliament. You know what David says? He says, I'm not going to take the crown from your hand. I'll not take it from an enemy's hand. Can you see the point? How will David get to the throne? He will not get to the throne by an enemy's hand. Now, one day there was an enemy in this world that offered the Lord the kingdoms of this world in a moment of time. He offered him the crown. So that's not how I'm going to get to the throne. Mind you, then there's a whole lot of people. There's all these battles that go on, and Joab and Abner and Ishbosheth and all of this. There's all this political maneuvering going on. And people are killed, and Joab, David's commander, thinks he can get David to the throne, and Abner thinks he can cut a deal. Abner was Saul's chief of staff, and he tries to make a political deal with David. And throughout those chapters, the whole point is this: David refuses every offer for a man to make him king. How does he eventually come to the throne? We read those verses. First of all, it was the head of the tribes of Judah. They come and they just say to David, we want you to be our king. What about the Israel? How did he convince them? He didn't convince them at all. He says they came of their own volition. They recognized that God had anointed this man. He was the rightful king. And of their own volition, they came and anointed David to be their king. You see the point? How does God get his man to the throne? Not by conspiracy. Not by any allegiances with the enemy against the nation of Israel to fight against them. Not from the hands of a man who are going to make him king. He's going to wait for God to bring him to the throne. That's the historical setting. A moral in 2 minutes. There's a very simple theme that runs through these whole two books, and it says you'll see it in the way that the literature is laid out. It's laid out in sort of a sense of a couplet, if you like, between people. You have the first few stories, don't you? There's a contrast between Hannah and Peninnah, right at the very beginning of 1 Samuel. God's almost establishing straight away there's a difference between the flesh and the spirit. And what's of man and what's of God. Then you have a contrast between Eli's sons and Samuel. And again, what's of the flesh and what's of God. Then you're going to have Saul and David contrasted. What's of the flesh and what's of God. And then in the last part, you'll have Absalom and David contrasted. What's of the flesh and what's of... And there's a very simple thing that runs through that. One was this. With regards to those that were marked by the flesh, it was all confidence in the flesh. Those that were marked by the Spirit of God all had confidence in the Lord. The first was always set aside, Peninnah. God took up Hannah. Eli's son set aside, God takes up Samuel. Saul, what's of the flesh, the first man, set aside, God takes up David. And then eventually God will show that Absalom too was wrong in what he did. God preserves then what is of the Spirit. Now I want to finish now, if you allow me 2 minutes, just to take, if you like, we've tried to trace the historical and some of these historical events, how they fitted together, how the case was made. We've looked at the principle that God was establishing behind these stories. Why did he do what he did? Why did he set Saul aside? And it was because he was a man after the flesh. God couldn't use a man like that, a man that had confidence in the flesh. Why would he take up David? Because he was a man that was going to rely on God to bring him to the throne. He was a man whose confidence was in the Lord. He was a man that was trusting God and of the Spirit, you see. So there's a moral reason for why God did what he did. Now let's look at that third level, if you like. How did God go about it? What was his strategy? I think this is amazing if you stop and think. There is a problem here that is far greater than just Saul. Why did Saul come to the throne in the first place? It's the people had booted God off the throne and they wanted a king just like all the nations. The whole purpose, therefore, of to bring David to the throne was not just to get rid of Saul. That was a problem, but it wasn't the ultimate problem. The ultimate problem was that God had been usurped from the hearts of his people. So God's ultimate strategy is therefore to regain the loyalty of his people through a man he will bring to the throne. Can you see that? Now, how does God go about doing it? Well, the first thing is this, he lets the people have what they wanted. Let them have a full feast of the flesh in Saul. Probably with the idea that they ought to have never wanted it in the first place. Doesn't God do that even today? Just let man, if man's determined to boot God off the throne, God says, okay, you have your way then and see how that feels. See what it's like to be driven and motivated by the flesh. Then God brings in another man, the second man, running in parallel, mind you, for a while. The people had ample opportunity to look at what was of the flesh and what was of God at the same point. And then he's going to bring him to the throne. And I'll close with this. He did it, first of all, winning the allegiance. Now notice this. He's going to win the allegiance of the people back to God. First step, win the allegiance of people to David. And then by doing that, the people's heart will be won to God. Now let's think about how that happened. How did he win the allegiance of the people to David? Well, we saw that in chapter 18. It was love. You ever thought of that as a strategy? You know what? The enemy never thought of it as a strategy. Saul certainly didn't think of it. There was a day he wanted the allegiance of the nation of Israel. He was going off to battle, and he wanted a whole lot of men to come with him. And so he cut up a whole yoke of oxen and sent it out by DHL or whatever it was in those days. You know, and the doorbell rang, and the fellow went down and opened his front door, and there was a visitor from Saul with a bit of an oxen. The man said, "Oh, that's very kind of you." He says, "Yeah, Saul would like you to join him. And by the way, if you don't join him, you'll end up like this bit of oxen." I said, that's one way to win the allegiance of the people, isn't it? By fear. Not David. David's going to win the allegiance of these people out of love. They're going to come to love him. What a strategy. Mind you, everything's now going to hinge then on what David does with that allegiance. It can go to people's head. I think we've seen it in our day. When the popularity of the people gets to a leader's head, it can ruin a man. What happens with David? When the allegiance of all the tribes have now come to David, you know what happens in chapter 6? He's going to bring the ark back to Jerusalem. He's established Jerusalem as the capital city. And he says, "But gentlemen, there's something missing. We need to bring the ark back." Brings the ark back, does something very strange again. Again, he's a bit hassled by the preachers on this. He dances before the ark. Mind you, it's not just the preachers that give him a hard time. His wife, Michael, gave him a right hard time. She said, perhaps as many wives had said when they consider their husbands in public, "So you put disgrace on the family name. What are you doing? Just like a common man, an ordinary man. Where are your royal garments? You're the king. You've established this. You've brought the nation to all of this. This is all you. And now you're just acting like a common person, dancing before the ark." You know what he said? I'll paraphrase it. He said, on an occasion like this, when it's the presence of God that's being brought back to the midst of his people, I'd be quite pleased just to be a common man. No royal garments now. Why? Because I want God to be glorified. And at the end of chapter 6, the people offer sacrifices, raise their heart to God. And God has brought a man to the throne who had won the allegiance of the people to him, but for this purpose, that he might ultimately win the allegiance of his people to the heart of God itself. What a marvelous strategy. You see, it's worth looking at these different levels, I trust. And I hope I haven't strayed too far over time. You'll forgive me. Shall we pray?